Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to our first Friday with Friday of 2023. It is January 6th. Just wanted to give everybody a quick heads up. I'm at the tail end of a cold, so I'm going to sound a little bit bad tonight. It's okay. I got cough drops. Got some water right next to me. Should be okay by the end of the meeting. So real quick, for those that are currently in the meeting, I wanted to encourage everybody to hover over your window for Zoom and have two tabs open for the duration of the presentation. Those two tabs are going to be the participants tab that will allow you to see everybody else that's in the meeting, including their name and whatever information they decide to include. You'll see with my name, I have put simply IDF for I'm Dave Friday, as well as PG2, my current title, my initiating chapter, which was Beta Iota, and my initiation year of 2002, as well as my pronouns. Anybody else, you are welcome to include whatever information you'd like as far as identifying yourself is concerned. The other tab I'd like to encourage everybody to have open is going to be the chat tab. For the chat tab, I believe the chat is a really good way to communicate during the presentation so that if you have questions or comments, I can keep my eyes on the chat and allow Teddy to just continue to present, and then I can communicate those to him as is necessary. So I'm already seeing some names changing, which is great to see. Yeah, I think that we are about ready to go ahead and get started. So first off, sorry that we didn't do this in December. That particular weekend was what we refer to in my department as Hell Weekend, which is where we give all of our last department tests before we're about to give our finals the next week. And we have a lot of grading to do. So combine that with a whole bunch of rituals taking place. It was quite a busy week or weekend for me. I'm glad that we are able to do this again today in the month of January. So with all of that in mind, brothers, allow me to... excuse me, brothers, allow me to introduce Brother Teddy Granius. Teddy was initiated into the Alpha Sigma chapter at Butler University in the spring of 2018. If you happen to know his province number, I'm sure he'll be more than enthusiastic to lead a little chant about it later tonight.
Later tonight.
Of course. During his time with the chapter, Teddy served in the roles of Warden, Fraternal Education Officer, Vice President, Alumni Relations Officer, and Chapter President. He earned his bachelor's degree in arts administration and political science. Now he works as a congressional staffer in the U.S. House of Representatives. His hobbies include working out, playing basketball, volleyball, and soccer, posting in Memes for Brotherhood, the famous Facebook group, reading, cars, film, and in his downtime, working with an amateur production company based out of Chicago. He also has a pet dog by the name of Ajax, a Cocker Spaniel Poodle mix, whom I'm sure we all hope to catch a glimpse of during the presentation. The title of his presentation is Famous Sinfonians Outside of the Music Industry. Brothers, please join me in a warm welcome for Brother Teddy Granius.
All right. Brother Dave Friday, thank you very much for having me tonight. I was really excited when I got the go-ahead to come and do this. I've heard great things about this. I've been in one or two of these sessions, but I finally got the chance to present, so I'm excited. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen real quick, and we'll get started.
That's a permission that I actually remembered to do, for the record.
All right. And you guys can just see my screen, right? There's nothing. There's no like. Okay, cool. So I did choose to present Famous Sinfonians Outside the Music Industry. I chose this for a number of reasons. My first one being... that I am outside the music industry. I did not study music. Obviously, I have a great love for it and a great passion for it, but I chose a different route in life. And there have been so many brothers that that have gone in different directions and done just phenomenal things. And it's always really cool when I hear about a brother that's done something, you know, outside of music. And you know, obviously I have a great respect for the music industry, but I just think it's really cool seeing people do things outside of it. So we're going to, do my little preface here. And I kind of summarize it in one quote, and that's by Brother Percy Jewett Burrell, and I'm sure everyone in this room has heard it before. And he wrote it in a declaration to the, as when he was president of the entire fraternity. He wrote this in a declaration to the national fraternity. No such question was put as, "How well can you sing, young man? What can you play, sir? But come on, boys, let's get together." This was the slogan that struck the ear and stirred the heart, for it meant something for sociability's sake, good fellowship, and mutual helpfulness. Percy Jewett Burrell. And that to me summarizes kind of why I wanted to do this. Our fraternity is unique in the fact that it's not just for musicians, it's for people who love music. And those people who love music can do all sorts of things, display all sorts of talents, all stuff like that, while still recognizing, music for music's sake, manly musician, musicianly man, all that, and still do just phenomenal things outside of music itself. This quote in general has always struck with me, so I just wanted to share it. It just kind of shows me that this fraternity accepts, everyone, regardless of musical talent. And a lot of those people go on to do great things outside of the music industry. So let's get started. So what I have prepared is just a PowerPoint of famous brothers who have done things outside the industry, facts about them. I'll obviously elaborate on a lot of their stories and stuff like that. Some informational slides are longer than others. That's either because I found these guys particularly interesting, or because there was just so much information about them that I didn't want to leave out, that I found, really important and that I wanted to include. All right, so our first brother is Captain Winston E. Scott, United States Navy. And I'm sure a lot of you guys have heard of him. He was a United States Navy aviator and NASA astronaut. He spent over 24 days in space, with three spacewalks, and served as mission specialist on two separate STSs, which are the designation for space shuttles. He has over 5,000 flight hours logged in over 20 different aircraft, which in itself is remarkable. And these are both military and civilian aircraft. He considered himself just an avid aviator. Didn't matter what he was flying. So he owned a lot of aircraft. He flew a lot of aircraft both outside and inside the Navy. That part of that reason is what made his career as a naval aviator so successful. I have his mission bottom two, or his mission insignia for this, the bottom two pictures next to him are the mission insignia for his space shuttle missions. And then the emblem of the United States Navy, as well as the rank he held, as a thank you. Oh, that's cool. As a captain, which is an 06, a very high-ranking officer rank. Education and early career. He was initiated by the Epsilon Iota chapter at Florida State University in 1970. That was when he was a undergrad. He got his bachelor in music, or his bachelor in music, and then his master's in aeronautical science from the United States Navy post grad school. So he was commissioned out right after his undergrad, and then entered naval specialist schools. The Navy is really, the armed forces in general are really unique in that they have specialized schools that they can offer, that offers degrees if you agree to serve. He entered Aviation Officer Candidate School in 1972, earned his wings in 74, which means he was officially rated to fly by the Navy. Sorry, I was just checking the chat. By the Navy, earning your wings takes a very long time. Flight school is extremely, extremely difficult. It's very taxing, both mentally and physically. And he earned his ratings in both fixed and rotary wing aircraft. So, airplanes and helicopters, but he mostly flew aircraft, particularly fighter aircraft. Which in itself is very impressive. Flight school has a very high washout rate. You served multiple tours of duty in multiple kinds of aircraft from 80 to 92, which again is impressive because most military pilots don't change aircraft. They specialize in a single type of aircraft and stick with that for most of their career. So that in itself is very impressive, shows how impressive he was as a pilot. He was selected by NASA as part of 1992 NASA Group 14. Astronauts are selected in specific groups, selected in specific groups in sections per year. So you submit your application, and you get accepted. Not very, very rigorous and thorough selection. He served as a mission specialist on STS-72. Which was the SS Endeavour space shuttle, and the STS 87 and 97, which was the SS Columbia, the later ill-fated Columbia in 1997. He logged an impressive total of 24 days, 14 hours, and 34 minutes in space, three spacewalks, total 19 hours and 22 minutes. Incredibly taxing on the body in itself, very impressive. He retired from both the U.S. Navy and NASA in 1999, with the rank of Captain 06. It's likely if he had stayed in the Navy and not gone on to be an astronaut, he would have made Admiral at some point. And there's him playing trumpet with his little space jacket on. You can see his flight wings on his left chest. And if you see someone wearing that patch with wings on it, doesn't matter what color they are. If they're gold, they're a Navy pilot, and if they're silver, they're an Army or Air Force pilot. And the bottom picture is him in his Navy dress blues. After retiring, he went on to serve at his alma mater, FSU, as Vice President for Student Affairs. He was very involved in Florida State University for a large chunk of his life. And later served as director of the Florida Space Authority. He advised state leadership in all matters, both civilian and military. He worked with the governor, he worked with the Florida House and Senate, and he worked with the Federal Aviation Administration as well. Instrumental in combining with this is largely overlooked because of his astronaut career, but he combined the instrumental in combining the Florida Space Authority, the Florida Aerospace Finance Corps, and the Florida Space Research Institute into what is now one entity, which is called Space Florida. There's a very large aerospace presence in Florida, so this was a really big deal. He really streamlined kind of that whole concentration in Florida. And he was named a signature Symphonian in 2009, which is also very, very cool. And on the left is a collage of him in his suit playing trumpet on a spacewalk. That's an insane photo. And then there's here, you can see those space wings, those flight wings that I talked about. So this was one of my favorite guys to research and then write about, Thomas E. Dewey. He, in my opinion, had one of the most impressive legal careers ever. He was a politician and a lawyer who served as the 47th governor of New York and district attorney, where he was instrumental, huge in derailing several American mafia bosses, most notably Charles Lucky Luciano and Waxy Gordon. They were both, New York gangsters. He most famously served as Republican nominee for president in both 1944 and 1948. He lost both times, and I'll explain later kind of why he lost the way he did, and what kind of led to that. He did, however, play a large role in Dwight D. Eisenhower's successful run in 1952. He chose a lot of members of his cabinet. And because of his impressive legal career, Dewey was offered the position of Chief Justice of the United States by Dwight D. Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, and he declined it both times, which is kind of a baller move, if you ask me. Very, Very cool, but also very impressive to get offered that position twice. So he was born and raised in Owosso, Michigan, the Epsilon chapter in 1919, at the University of Michigan. He was also a member of the Men's Glee Club at Michigan, and he wanted to pursue a career in music, but found it too risky, which I honestly thought was pretty funny. He started a very lucrative practice on Wall Street, left his practice to fight the corruption he saw in New York as a prosecutor. So right after earning his law degree, he went straight back to New York. And he was in Chicago for a brief amount of time and then went back to New York again. It was in this position he earned his first official title as a chief assistant U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. Corruption and organized crime in the 1920s and 1930s were huge in New York. I mean, you see all those movies and everything. You see like all of Al Capone and whoever else. It was a big deal. So he really fought against that, and was very adamant about prosecuting that and finding getting like to the source of that crime. So chief assistant U.S. attorney for that district was a big deal for him. He first made headlines by successfully prosecuting mob boss Waxy Gordon. He at the time he was a famous bootlegger. With alcohol being illegal, he illegally produced, sold, and transported insane amounts of alcohol throughout New York, which was a lot of trouble for the New York Police Department, which at the time was extremely loosely organized and not very well maintained, as well as other forms of organized crime, prostitution, kidnappings, money laundering, all sorts of stuff. Dewey was known for his excellent recollection of details and intricacies of crimes, which he often used to distract and unnerve lying witnesses. So he would spit the facts back out them super, super quickly and in insane detail. And when witnesses were trying to lie to him, he'd break down their lies just by spitting the facts back out of them. His wit and attention to detail, along with his staff, became very legendary in New York. He became kind of a celebrity after the whole Waxy Gordon prosecution, and that bolstered his career quite a bit. He became special prosecutor. He was appointed special prosecutor in New York County. Democrat Governor Herbert Lehman nominated four prominent Republicans at the time to serve as special prosecutor. All four of them refused, and all four of them recommended Brother Thomas Dewey. New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, also a brother, gave Dewey a squad of 60 men for his staff, some police officers, some detectives, some lawyers, some civilians, and told him immediately go after organized crime. LaGuardia considered it also a huge issue in New York, and went after it very adamantly. And that is one thing that LaGuardia was also very well known for. This is a quote I thought was just really cool. Writer summarized Dewey's actions as a prosecutor, writing, "What he appealed to most was the great American love of results. People were much more interested in his ends than in his means. Another key to all this may be expressed in a single word: honesty. Dewey was honest." I just think that was really cool. And having something like that published about a prominent figure in New York back then, a very corrupt city with corrupt politicians and corrupt lawmakers, was a big deal. So this is where his career got a little hairy. One of Dewey's biggest cases was against mobster Dutch Schultz, another bootlegger, and mob boss, basically, who he tied in court and deadlocked multiple times. He wasn't able to fully prosecute, wasn't able to get any solid convictions, and that was really frustrating for Dewey, but it was also really frustrating for Schultz, because Schultz knew that Dewey had him pat it very closely. And any other slip up, and Dewey could have him thrown in jail. So Schultz arranged to have Dewey assassinated. But gangster Lucky Luciano and other mob bosses didn't want their gang circle disrupted with a new prosecutor. And they also thought Schultz was going to be sloppy in his assassination of Dewey. So they had Schultz murdered instead. So now mobster Schultz is out of the picture. After Schultz's murder, Dewey turned his attention to Luciano. Luciano saved his life, very likely, but Luciano is also one of the most well-known mobsters in New York. He and assistant DA Eunice Carter, who was one of the first African-American women to be DA of New York, and also extremely successful one at that, raided over 80 prostitution houses in New York, arrested hundreds of people, a lot of whom were willing to testify against Luciano to avoid prison time. So they did. Dewey prosecuted Luciano's case, won the conviction for prostitution, gave him a sentence of 30 to 50 years. He got him on other petty crimes as well, bootlegging, money laundering, stuff like that. As Manhattan District Attorney, he famously convicted Richard Whitney of the New York Stock Exchange and American Nazi leader Fritz Kuhn, both for embezzlement. A lot of crimes back then were hard to prosecute. Lack of evidence was a big issue, but embezzlement was very easy to prove and also very common in a lot of these New York criminals. So he prosecuted on what he knew and what he did. Popular symbolic story from the time featured a young girl who told her father that she wanted to sue God to stop a long spell of rain. When her father goes, "You can't sue God and win," the girl replies, "I can if Dewey is my lawyer." Thought that was really cool. He won the New York gubernatorial election in 42 and served until 54. He's widely regarded as one of the most successful state governors of the 20th century by a lot of historians. He was integral in balancing the state's budget, reducing the state debt by over $100 million. He doubled state aid to education and increased state employee wages. And that's $100 million in 1950s money, not 2023 money. So that's pretty substantial. Dewey created a State Department of Commerce, a New York State Department of Commerce, to lure new businesses and tourists to the Empire State, ease the shift from wartime boom, and steer small businessmen, in particular, through the maze of federal regulation and restriction, end quote. He helped establish programs and funding for New York and its economy during the Second World War, also with the assistance of LaGuardia, which built space for 14,000 more hospital beds and public funding for 30,000 families. Both Dewey and LaGuardia were very big on these types of social programs, and they worked in tandem a lot. He retired from public office and the governorship in 1954. 1944 presidential election. He ran for president twice, like I mentioned before. He was nominated almost unanimously at the 1944 Republican National Convention and chose Ohio Governor John W. Bricker as his running mate. During the election, incumbent Franklin D. Roosevelt, who, as you guys know, had been serving since 1933 as president, in a kind of unorthodox turn of events, provided Dewey with significant information on the war effort. There was a lot of concern that Thomas Dewey wasn't was going to be sloppy with American secrets, war effort stuff. So FDR confided in him and told the United States that Dewey was a man to be trusted and a man that could be trusted with the security of the United States, which was. You would not see something like that happening today. And I think a very good show in bipartisanship in a presidential race, nothing less. Like I said, unorthodox showing between incumbent and his opposition, but he steadily lost to the very popular Roosevelt. Roosevelt was a titan back then. And if it weren't for his health, who knows how long he would have served. November of 44, he lost. With his 45.9% against FDR's 53.4, which is a very large margin. We haven't seen margin like that in a while. His greatest win against any of his previous Republican opponents. So here's a famous photo. It's Harry Truman holding a Chicago Daily that says Dewey defeats Truman. It says Truman lost, which was false. and they printed 150,000 copies of these. Dewey was the Republican nominee again in 1948, heavily favored to win against Incumbent Truman, who replaced FDR in 45 after his unfortunate death. Dewey was heavily favored to win, so much so that most Republicans felt all he had to do was avoid any potentially controversial statements. So they basically said, "Don't say anything bad and you'll win." He was therefore convinced to remain as nonpartisan as possible in his speeches and events, which isn't a terrible tactic, but it proved to be very unsuccessful. The strategy proved to be a total failure, as Truman used it to repeatedly criticize and insult Dewey publicly. And since Dewey didn't wanted to be as nonpartisan as possible, he really didn't defend himself, didn't say anything back, made very cautious comments, showing to be extremely weak in response. A lot of people said, "Dewey, you got to turn this around and you got to go on the attack mode. You got to defend yourself and you got to make some statements. Show yourself to be, a big dog politically." And his wife convinced him not to. Chicago Tribune infamously posted Dewey defeats Truman, posting 150,000 printings before the results of Truman winning the election in one of the biggest upsets in United States history. He barely lost Illinois, California, and Ohio by less than a point, which would have won him the election if he had won all three of those states. Any two of those states would have forced a contingent vote in the House of Representatives. That was a lot of information very quickly, but Thomas Dewey, very illustrious career, very, very successful career, and extremely impressive in my opinion, even after losing two of those races. My next is Brother Fred Rogers. He's probably one of the most famous brothers in this brotherhood. Even after his death, he's continuously going viral online. People still look to his words of advice and stuff for comfort, and rightfully so. He's extremely warm and kind soul. So Fred McFeely Rogers was a television host, personality, author, producer, and Presbyterian minister. Not sure if you guys knew that. He was both the creator and host of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, a popular television series for children, which ran for over 30 years from 68 to 01. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 01 and inducted in the Television Hall of Fame in 99. He was, after his death, like I said, remembered as one of the most beloved personalities in American culture. Personally, absolutely love this man. Grew up watching his shows when I was a little kid, and I remember him always putting on that sweater, and putting on his sneakers. And fun fact, those sweaters he wore every show, those were knitted by his mother, every single one. Talk about drip. The man was absolutely dripped out. He looked great. Early life and TV career. He was born in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. He attended Dartmouth College, an Ivy League, before transferring to Rollins, getting a bachelor in music. Just like Dewey. He graduated from the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary in 62 with a bachelor's in divinity and ordained as a minister in the next year. A bachelor's in divinity is a degree a seminarian would use in order to get ordained. He worked as a program developer for WQED, developing the show The Children's Corner. And there was a lot of, the show was somewhat similar to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in the fact that it had a lot of puppets and characters that weren't real, all of which Mr. Rogers created and developed himself, many of which, excuse me. And a lot of these he brought over with him to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. He went back to Toronto to work for the Canadian Broadcasting Company. Sorry, he moved to Toronto, not back to Toronto. My apologies. To work for the Canadian Broadcasting Company to host Mr. Rogers, a 15-minute black and white children's show that was the predecessor to his title show. He acquired the rights to Mr. Rogers in 1967 and moved back to Pittsburgh despite his success and potential with the CBC. A lot of the puppeteers he worked with at the CBC and a lot of the producers he worked with came over with him to Pittsburgh. He had them on a show or he had them producing or developing and stuff like that. So he took his connections with him back to Pittsburgh. That proved to be a very wise choice on his part, just career-wise. So Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood started airing in 1968 and ran for an impressive 895 episodes, videotaped in Pittsburgh by, I'm supposed to say by, not but, by the National Education Television, which later became PBS. The format of the show remained consistent throughout its entire run. So it started the same, ended the same, with both human and puppet characters present in the show. The show focused on the emotional and social development of children, as opposed to maybe the cognitive development, which you would see in a show like Sesame Street, where they teach you the ABCs or 1, 2, 3. The show kind of focuses more on life lessons and morals and stuff like that, giving the audience very basic examples of ethical and moral reasoning. And it was done in Roger's well-known, reassuring, and understanding tone, which is something that, really people really attribute to him. He wrote and edited every single episode, as well as singing all the songs, of which he wrote 200. And he wrote third. There was 13 operas in that show, all of which he wrote. He created almost all the characters. Like I said, a lot of these characters he created before Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. The most notably, the characters were recurring ones from the neighborhood of make-believe, with the little trolley and the puppets and the king and stuff like that. He played most of those roles as well. He was an experienced puppeteer, which he learned at the CBC. The show ended in 2001, when Rogers was 73. During its tenure, it became extremely popular. At its peak in 85 and 86, it reached 22.1% of homes at its peak. It ended in 2001, mostly because of his age, and he was diagnosed with stomach cancer shortly thereafter, unfortunately. So his legacy, he's had a very long-standing legacy in the United States, and that won't die down anytime soon, in my opinion. Rogers' approach to children's shows and his adherence to methods of psychology, children's psychology, inspired many other children's shows, such as Arthur, Blue's Clues, and Wonder Pets. The creator of Arthur speaks very highly of Mr. Rogers very often. In 1969, Rogers testified before the United States Senate Subcommittee on Communications when the PBS funding was going to get cut in half by Richard Nixon from $20 million to $10 million. That's obviously in 1969 money. The video of Rogers' testimony went viral numerous times online, notably in 2012 and 2017, when more budget cuts for PBS and public broadcasting were proposed, saving the station millions in proposed budget cuts. And that's all because of Mr. Rogers. And you can find that video online. I'll drop it in the link after I'm done with this presentation. He was extremely sought out for interviews, but he got pretty bad anxiety during these interviews. He didn't like them all that much. But he really liked commencement speeches. He gave over 150 commencement speeches at all different universities. And the 2019 film, Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, tells Roger's story with his distant cousin, Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks is Fred Rogers' sixth cousin, playing Fred Rogers. And that movie was also extremely popular, but obviously not as popular as Mr. Rogers. And I put a little quote right here. I hope you noticed in all three of the pictures he was wearing his little red sweaters. Often when you think you're at the end of something, you're at the beginning of something else. Fred Rogers. And I forget what that puppet's name is, sort of in the back of my head, but he created that character. That's one of his most famous characters that he created.
That's King Friday right there.
King Friday, how could I forget?
As a representative of the Friday clan,
Absolutely.
gotta look out for him.
Absolutely. Thank you for reminding me. Can't believe I forgot. But yeah, that's King Friday, Mr. Rogers, and he's wearing his usual outfit. So this next guy is a pretty unknown guy. I don't think any of you guys think of him when you think of famous sinfonians. But George Banta, there's him with his absolutely killer mustache. He was founder of the Banta Printing Company, now the Banta Corporation. You can look that up, worth about 1.5 billion at this point, and an influential figure for a number of well-known Greek organizations, and that was his main claim to fame, particularly Phi Delta Theta fraternity, which I am also a brother of, and Delta Gamma Women's fraternity. His work for Delta Gamma was arguably more important than it was for Phi Delta Theta. He really helped that organization grow nationally. He started and wrote Banta's Greek Exchange, a monthly review of fraternity and sorority happenings, and also published a number of versions of Baird's Manual of American College Fraternities. Some of you older guys might have heard of that publication. It stopped being publicized in 1992, I believe, but it went on for a good 60 or 70 years. Actually, probably longer than that. So Greek involvement and work. I did the kind of four crests of four organizations he either was a part of or helped organize. Banta was initiated into Phi Delta Theta at Franklin College and was an active member during his tenure. He later worked as a national historian to the fraternity. And was a very large part of the fraternity's expansion nationally. They were very centralized in certain areas of the Midwest. He helped expand them south and east, which I actually learned a lot about during my time in Phi Delta Theta. He was also instrumental in expanding Delta Gamma Women's Fraternity. Yes, it's a women's fraternity, not the sorority, outside the United States South, because they were very stuck in the US South. And we're having a lot of trouble expanding north and west, but founding it at his alma mater, Franklin College. The chapter was designated the Phi chapter in honor of Phi Delta Theta, and Delta Gamma initiated him into their women's fraternity, only man to be initiated into the fraternity thus far, which is also very interesting. Banta was also instrumental in the formation of new Greek organizations, particularly Alpha Gamma Delta, which is that crest in the lower left, and Banta was elected an honorary member of Phi Mu Alpha Symphonia by the Alpha chapter on December 20th, 1917. I want to clarify something real quick. The Alpha chapter seems to have elected a lot of members honorary in 1917, 1918. They did this with Andrew Carnegie. They did this with Charles Schwab. They did this with a number of very prominent members of the United States in general. Alpha chapter has initiated a lot of honorary members. So a lot of the honorary members that you see that are famous sinfonians are honorary members because of the Alpha chapter. There is some controversy to that. A lot of people think they decide on that too easily, handed out too many honorary memberships. But if you're like me, you're just glad to see the fraternity grow in any way it can. Not sure why. It was in 1917 particularly. That's when a lot of honorary members were done. George Eastman was an entrepreneur who founded the Eastman Kodak Company, a big role in mainstreaming the photographic use of roll film in the industry. He was also a notable philanthropist, establishing the Eastman School of Music, the Rochester Philharmonic, schools of dentistry and medicine at the University of Rochester, and also some schools of dentistry abroad. Founding a presidency of Kodak, he became interested in photography in the 1870s, founded the Eastman Dry Plates Company in 81, and 1888 patented and released the Kodak camera. Yeah, he made the Kodak camera, which made photography much more accessible to people in general. And the company was incorporated as Eastman Kodak in 1892. The company grew very rapidly in the 1890s and was soon the leading supplier of film stock internationally. And Eastman took interest in color film in 1904. and funded projects for color film within the next decade. There was some controversy surrounding that. The federal government began to an antitrust investigation on Eastman and Kodak in 1911, which resulted in a lawsuit in 1913 and concluded 8 years later in 1921, when they ordered him to stop fixing prices. Among other things, it cost him about $5 million in 1913 money, which is very, very significant. And on the right is his original patent in 1888 for the Kodak camera. It looks interior-wise, it looks very similar to those Kodak cameras you see today, but it's not, shaped like a regular box. Here's him on Time Magazine. Thought that was awesome. He donated more than 100 million, 2 billion adjusting for inflation of various projects in Rochester, particularly the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester and the School of Medicine and Dentistry there, like I mentioned before. He established the Eastman Dental Dispensary in 16 and the UCL Eastman Dental Institute in 1931, which is now a part of University College London and still there today. Founded the Eastman School of Music, where he ended up being initiated as an honorary member. Very cool. Founded it so they could initiate him. He looked to the future, founded the Eastman School of Music, like I had mentioned, and was an honorary. I apologize, I didn't put what year that was. The only person honored by two separate stars in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, both recognizing him for developing bromide paper, which is like photography paper, which is very commonly used in the film industry. So Hollywood owes him a lot of a big debt of gratitude for kind of blowing up their industry, honestly, making filmmaking much easier to do. This guy was interesting. This guy was involved in the music industry, but not primarily. He did have some trouble with it. I thought he was a cool character, and he did a lot of stuff outside of music, so I included him anyway. Major Henry Lee Higginson. Higginson was a businessman, United States Army officer, and Harvard University patron, who also founded the Boston Symphony Orchestra. He attained the rank of colonel in the army, but he was referred to as major for the rest of his life to avoid confusion between him and his cousin, also referred to as Colonel Higginson, and therefore will be referred to as such. Higginson entered the Union Army in 1861, towards the beginning of the war, and commissioned as a second lieutenant of Company D, Colonel George H. Gordon's 2nd Massachusetts Regiment. He fought in the First Battle of Bull Run, a very significant battle, and was promoted to major in the 1st Massachusetts Cavalry within a year of originally commissioning. Not uncommon, I'll explain why. In the Battle of Aldie, Higginson was thrown off his horse and earned multiple bullet wounds and three saber cuts in one day. And was sent to recover from his wounds in Boston. That's where he met his wife. He left the army in 1865, having attained the rank of colonel within 4 years. Not too uncommon during the years of the Civil War. Nowadays, it'll take you about 20 to 25 years to do that if you're an officer. The reason so is because so many of our officers were killed during the Civil War that they had to promote a lot of men very quickly. Some of them very underqualified and very young. He was very good friends with Colonel Robert Shaw, who led a company of all African American soldiers. And Colonel Robert Shaw was only 25. Nowadays, colonels would be in their 50s or 60s. Post-military, founded the Boston Symphony Orchestra in 81. He hired Sir Ida Source George Herschel as the first music director. He was extremely strict with his musicians. Not allowing them to play for any other entity and making them adhere to very strict contracts. He left the management of the orchestra to a board of directors in 1918. He had a lot of financial troubles with them. It was kind of stressing him out, so he said, "All right, have at it." Now they're extremely successful. Well, in my opinion, it was for the best. In 1882, Higginson served as president of the Harvard Club of Boston. He loved Harvard. In 1890, he presented Harvard with a gift of 31 acres of land, which he called Soldier Field, to commemorate his fallen comrades from the Army and from the Civil War, notably Charles Lowell and, like I mentioned before, Colonel Robert Shaw. were both killed in action. It is now Harvard's baseball field, still standing there today, and it's a very nice field. In 1915, Higginson was a participant in the first transcontinental telephone call, along with Thomas Watson, Alexander Graham Bell, Theodore Vail, and Woodrow Wilson. How's that for a lineup? He was very outspoken dude, though, very critical of pretty much every American president, but never actually held any political position. In 1916, he accepted election to honorary membership in Phi Mu Alpha Symphonia, again by the Alpha chapter. Here's another guy you might recognize, brother J.K. Simmons. Simmons is an actor best known for portraying Terrence Fletcher in Whiplash, J. Jonah Jameson in the Spider-Man trilogy. He's won numerous accolades, including an Academy Award, a British Film Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award, and a Golden Globe. Holy hell. Crazy lineup of awards right there. Not many actors get to do that. But he's not the only Symphonian to have won an Academy Award. The other ones have won them for either composition or just general music. But they are unfortunately not in this presentation. There he is in his uniform as a plain young army officer. I don't know what that's from, but that's just a screen grab from one of his acting roles. He's born in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. It's a suburb of Detroit in 55. Went to the University of Montana. Initiated in the Phi Mu Alpha Symphonia by the Delta chapter while he was an undergrad. Graduated with a degree in music. What a guy. Moved to Seattle and he became a member of the Seattle Repertory Theater, which helped him get his first Broadway gig, which led him to acting in general. Multiple Broadway roles. He was in Guys and Dolls, Carousel, Birds on Paradise, and Peter Pan. Simmons made his first appearance in a live-action television role in the show Popeye Doyle, appearing as a patrol officer. That's not what this is from, but yeah, it's a cool screen grab nonetheless. Looks a lot younger than that. Excuse me. Simmons played J. Jonah Jameson, editor-in-chief of the newspaper Daily Bugle, in all three of the Spider-Man films. He was in Robot Chicken for 7 years, playing a number of characters. You guys probably recognize his voice from that. In 14, arguably the most successful point of his career, he played Terrence Fletcher, a bandmaster at a conservatory who bullies and abuses his students. The performance in the film were extremely well perceived. He won a number of awards for this part, including a Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actor and the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor, beating out a number of other big names. Academy Awards of 2015. In his speech, all he said what he wanted the audience to do was call your parents, and tell them you love them. So, on behalf of J.K. Simmons, after this, call your parents, tell them that you love them. From 2014 to 2020, Simmons voiced Lenny Turtletaub, I don't know how to pronounce that, and BoJack Horseman. He's also popular from that. Well known for his commercials is Professor Nathaniel Burke and the Farmers Insurance commercials, he's the yellow M&M. I honestly didn't know that, but I thought that was interesting, so I put that in there. He was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor again in 2022, but he lost to Troy Kotsur. James G. Martin. Martin is a politician and chemist who served as governor of North Carolina from 85 to 93. He also served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 12 years, serving on the most prestigious committee in the House, the Ways and Means Committee, and served as chairman of the House Republican Research Committee. He was born in 1935 in Savannah, Georgia, and was raised in South Carolina. He graduated from Davidson College in 57 with a degree in science. He was a talented tuba player and initiated in the Gamma Kappa chapter of Phi Mu Alpha Symphonia in 1955. Was also active in the chapter Beta Theta Pi on campus. So a double fraternity man, just like myself. Martin received his PhD in chemistry from Princeton University in 1960, and then served as associate professor of chemistry at his alma mater at Davidson College. Davidson College is where Stephen Curry went, if I am correct. He ran for Congress in 72. That's the year he stopped teaching at Davidson College. I'm trying to see if I forgot anything. Nope. There's him again. Actually, both those pictures I just showed you of him were taken on the same day. He was elected to the U.S. House in 72, sworn in 73. He swore in January, representing the 9th Congressional District of North Carolina. Served on the Committee of Ways and Means, most prestigious committee, like I mentioned, and was the first politician to earn the Charles Lathrop Parsons Award, given by the American Chemical Society for Public Service by an American chemist. In 1984, North Carolina Governor Jim Hunt left office, and Martin ran for the position and won, defeating Rufus Edmiston by a 9-point margin. Big margin. During his first term, he made one large promise to his constituents. He was going to fix the neglected Interstate 40 that had been an issue for a very long time. And he stayed true to that promise. The interstate was finished in 1988. Because of that, he was easily reelected in 88. And then after the next term, he retired from politics in 1993. Andy Griffith, another goat. Andy Griffith was an actor, a comedian, a musician, and a producer, best known for his role as Sheriff Andy Taylor in The Andy Griffith Show, which ran from 60 to 68. He also appeared in the television series Matlock, as Ben Matlock, another popular series. And he's a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame and was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2005, just like Brother Fred Rogers. And they were actually awarded it by the same president, President George W. Bush. Early life and education. Look at young Griffith. He looks so good with his haircut and his shirt. Yeah, that's a cool photo. Griffith was born in Mount Airy, North Carolina, in 1926. He started acting and singing in high school and multiple plays and musicals, and he attended UNC Chapel Hill, where he was graduate. He graduated with a bachelor in music, another typo, my apologies. After changing from studying to be a Moravian preacher, which is a form of Presbyterianism, I believe. At UNC Chapel Hill, he was initiated in the Alpha Rho chapter of Phi Mu Alpha, where he later served as chapter president. I played in several student operettas in college, including the Gondoliers and the HMS Pinafore. Pinafore is a personal favorite of mine. After college, he taught drama and music for a few years at Goldsboro High School in Goldsboro, North Carolina. But he later stopped to start his acting career, which led to the Andy Griffith Show, which is situational comedy sitcom aired in 60, where he played Andy Taylor. Like I said, it was on CBS. The show took place in the fictional quiet town of Mayberry, North Carolina, where he was sheriff and common friend of all the townsfolk. The show also starred comedian Don Knotts as Deputy Barney Fife, who was a longtime friend of Griffith. The show was a huge success, never dropping lower than seventh on the Nielsen ratings, with Knotts receiving a number of Emmy Awards for his performances. The show generated a number of successful spin-offs, legitimately successful spin-offs, notably Gomer Pyle, United States Marine Corps, and Return to Mayberry, which was just another show about the town of Mayberry. Although he never got writing credit for it, he did take a big part in development and writing of every episode, something that I don't think should be overlooked, but it was. Again, a very interesting show is kind of how he was involved in different aspects during the production. The show's reruns are still played consistently today, and the show is still very widely recognized, remaining Griffin's best-known work. However, he did a lot of other stuff. He was on the Ed Sullivan Show a number of times, starting in 48. He started Broadway in No Time for Sergeants, which later became a movie, and where he reprised his role, and where he first worked with Don Knotts. And for that role, he was nominated for a Tony for the Broadway version. He appeared in A Face in the Crowd in 57, his original film debut. People say he did an absolutely phenomenal job for it. He wasn't nominated for anything, but his role in that was very, very well praised. He started his own production company in 72 and produced a number of movies and television series. And in 78, he appeared in the popular movie series Centennial. Nominated for an Emmy in 81 for his portrayal of Ash Robinson in Murder in Texas, but did not win the Emmy. It was in 86 that he did Matlock, his second most well-known work, arguably, which inspired a number of movies as well, spin-off movies. And afterwards, Griffith called it his favorite role as an actor, actually, not Sheriff Andy Taylor. And there's him on set for a television show, getting all dressed, his hair, and looking over his script and smoking a cigarette. This is our last guy, Pierello LaGuardia. I mentioned him earlier. He was a New York politician and attorney who served as the 99th mayor of New York and represented the 14th and 20th districts of New York in the U.S. House of Reps. He's most well known for his mayoral tenure of New York, after which he's regarded as one of the best mayors in American history. He was mayor during the Great Depression and World War II and pursued a long series of political reforms in New York City that revamped and revitalized major sections and facets of the city. He was instrumental in revitalizing New York, and New York still has plenty to be grateful for. He ran for that U.S. House in 1914, but lost to Michael Farley. He ran again in 16 and won this time, but his tenure was interrupted by World War I. He was commissioned in 1917 as an officer into the Army Air Forces as a, and finished his career as a major and commanded a squadron of Caproni bombers on the Italian-Austrian front. Very early use of bombers, one of the first times this was used in warfare. So kind of an innovator there, and interesting fact a lot of people don't know about LaGuardia. You can see him there, like I mentioned before, when Winston Scott was wearing his jump wings right on his left breast. You can see LaGuardia wearing his as well. That just means you're a military pilot. He returned to Congress in 18 and was reelected four more times after that, so 8 years in the House, gaining a reputation as a very fiery and opinionated member of Congress. Noted for opposing prohibition and co-sponsoring the Norris LaGuardia Act, which restricted the courts to ban protests and punishments for labor groups. A very well-known act back then. Here's him getting angry at a, not getting angry, but being very loud at a rally for his campaigns. He ran for mayor of New York in 33, unseating Tammany Hall, a very corrupt politician. He earned a national reputation for being a bipartisan reformer who was dead set on improving the civic elements of New York City while strongly opposing corruption and organized crime, like I said earlier, working closely alongside brother Thomas Dewey. He built LaGuardia Airport, which was named after him, as well as numerous roads and bridges. He began expanding the city's social services and programs, which was huge back then because they had they that those that did not exist before him, as well as improve the operations of the fire and the police department, and the NYPD, and New York Fire Department are both very well respected organizations in New York now. And anytime you fly into LaGuardia, know that the airport's named after a brother, Brother LaGuardia. He was initiated as an honorary member of Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia by the Beta Gamma chapter, Columbia University in 1941, about 6.5 years before he passed. That's who I got on long-term information. Additional brothers I wanted to cover but didn't have time. Sorry, I was super busy this week, but also I knew this was going to take about an hour and didn't want to go over. Andrew Carnegie, founder of U.S. Steel and philanthropist, Alpha Chapter. Charles Schwab, industrialist, owner of Bethlehem Steel, Alpha Chapter. George Corlew, first U.S. Secretary of Commerce and Labor, Alpha Chapter. David Boren, former governor of Oklahoma, Mu Chapter. Harvey S. Mudd, namesake of Harvey Mudd College or University, whatever. Mining engineer, Cypress Mines Corporation, Beta Psi Chapter. Thomas W. Fox, peace activist, and Gamma Psi Chapter. And Art Gilmore, voice actor and radio personality. Those are some guys I wish I could have covered. Maybe I'll do something like that and publish it in the Symphonian later for you guys to read. But that's all I have. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen and pass it back over to Brother Friday. Thank you very much for listening. I know I talked a lot, threw a lot of information at you, but I hope you enjoyed and I hope you learned something. I definitely did when researching for this presentation. So thanks very much, guys.
This was an absolutely amazing presentation. I feel like I learned a ton from all of this. Let's take a moment to show some appreciation to Brother Greatness.
Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate that.
Yes, thank you very much. Before we formally conclude the presentation portion of the night, were there any questions for Teddy? Brother Herod.
Hey there. Really, really interesting presentation. I had no idea that LaGuardia was a brother. I had known about Dewey. One thing I'm always curious about with famous symphonians is, how much they're thinking about Sinfonia post, their time as a collegiate brother, or if they were an honorary brother. In your research, was there any anything that you saw about Dewey and LaGuardia knowing that each other, that they were brothers in Finding Alpha? Or is that just maybe kind of ancillary to, everything else with their relationship?
They worked. LaGuardia wasn't a brother until 41, and that
Got
would
it.
have been after they had worked together most of the part.
Okay.
I'm assuming no. But who knows? They could have reconnected at some point and talked about it. My assumption is not really, just because they were kind of working apart at that point.
Thanks.
Yeah, no problem.
All right. AJ, I see a yes by you. Does that indicate that you wanted to ask a question? Oh, now I'm seeing a no. All right, then we will move on. Brother Kowalski, go ahead.
Hello. That was really cool. I really enjoyed it. And I guess I was curious. I didn't know if you knew about this. I don't know if it would have been like in the. Sorry, I put the thing up again.
It's okay. I
But.
gotcha. I gotcha.
Do you know of any brothers who were involved in sports or anything like that? I guess I was just curious.
I couldn't find anything on that, honestly. A couple low-level sports announcers for collegiate teams. There's a couple one guy that did the voice for the Chicago Wolves, a minor league hockey team, but no actual athletes, to my knowledge. I'm sure there's some that kind of fly under the radar, but not necessarily.
Because
Sorry, continue.
oh no, I was just saying, I was doing my own research and I kind of came up with similar results of nothing.
The thing is, most professional athletes, when they're a collegiate athlete, are encouraged not to join any fraternal organizations. So I'm assuming that's a probably a big part as to why.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely.
I can actually verify. During my time at Michigan State, I sort of asked around. As an undergrad, I was at Albion College, which is a very small liberal arts college, and we had one fraternity in particular that seemed to attract a lot of the football players to it, which was Alpha Tau Omega. When I got to Michigan State, I asked a very ignorant question. So, what fraternity would the football players join here? And everybody pretty much agreed that if you're playing sports at a D1 school with the hopes of going pro after that, you don't have time for a fraternity. So those that would probably make it in the pros would probably not join a Greek letter organization. Brother Alexson. Saw the hand go down, but I'm not hearing any audio from you. Is your mic on?
You guys hear me okay?
We can hear you now. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks again, Teddy. That was a great presentation.
Thank you.
As someone that is outside of the music profession, I studied history and I had my BA in history. I'm always fond of this kind of stuff. To add to Tanner's question, I think I can shed a little bit of light. I know out of all the Sinfonians that Teddy presented, Tui was probably the most prominent in the fraternity. He served as supreme historian back in the 1920s and was actually a governor back when the fraternity was still districts. So going on a limb here, I would think that Dewey probably nudged LaGuardia to be a brother, even though that I don't think he was doing much during the time when he was, doing his stuff in law and became governor. But I like to assume he was still fairly active in the fraternity. But one comment I do have is, if any of you guys aren't, I would encourage you, if you're on Facebook, to join the Phi Mu Alpha research and discussion page. If you're someone that's really interested in the history, and I know a few of you guys on here are already a part of it, to be a part of that, because if you're ever doing research, I always find myself cross-referencing stuff. There's a very important document on there by Thomas Larimore, who was also a historian back in the 40s that did a ton of research on what Teddy had brought up about a lot of the brothers being initiated by the Alpha chapter. We had over 100 brothers in 1917 alone that were initiated, and he as early as the 1940s, the fraternity weren't the best record keepers. So even brothers back then were trying to figure out, well, why were we initiating so many guys in 1 year? If you ever find yourself wanting to learn about that, I can always send a link to that document.
Awesome. Yeah, please do. Please do. Unfortunately, I gotta bounce. I gotta be back on the house floor in about 20 minutes. So I gotta get back to the office for the next speaker vote. I apologize
I'll
for
be watching on TV.
all right.
Do your thing, Teddy.
You
Thank
might
you
be,
again.
yeah, thank you. You might
I
be
very
able to
much wanted to ask you about the speaker vote.
Shoot me a message if you want to. I got Facebook. Yeah, you might be able to see me on C-SPAN because I'll be on the gallery at least.
That's awesome.
All right, I'll talk to you guys later. Thank you so much for Brother Friday for having me.
Thank
Thank
you,
you.
Brother
Thank you.
Granius, once again. It was
Thank you.
fantastic having you here. Thank you so
Bye,
much.
Ted. Hail Sinfonia.
Bye, Ted.
See you, Teddy.
Congrats. Good job.
All right, and let the record show that this is probably the first time a presenter had to leave early to go be on national television. So that's pretty awesome.
Question.
I have to go back to the government.
Please note we're still recording.
All right, Brother Angel, yeah, you can probably shut that down at this point. Thank you very much for recording. Appreciate you.
You're welcome. Recording stopped.